This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Sophie Black. I'm co-head of programming here at the Wheeler Centre, and I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's very special event, the third annual Die Gribble Argument. Before we kick off, I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present and to the elders of any other communities who may be with us today. The late Die Gribble was a force in Australian cultural and intellectual life. Publisher, editor, businesswoman. Her impact on the world of books, writing and ideas cannot be overstated. She was tireless in her contributions. Founder of McPhee Gribble, text media, text publishing and private media, with stints as the deputy chair of the ABC and board member for The Lonely Planet, Care Australia, the Australia Council for the Arts, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, the Melbourne Major Events Company and Circus Oz. And now I'm out of breath. I was lucky enough to work for Die at private media, first as a small minion working on the magazine The Reader and then as editor of Crikey, of which she was publisher and co-owner. I engaged in many an argument with Die, a simultaneously exhilarating, educative and terrifying experience. Die detested unthinking assumptions and clichés. She taught us to think critically and deeply. She was open to having her mind changed, but she wasn't going to make it easy for you. She demanded that us poor schmucks defend our stance as eloquently as she challenged it, in her direct, clear-sighted way, with grace and humour and a twinkle in her eye. And so the Die Gribble argument is an occasion to remember Di and her legacy and, in her name, to put a bit of stick about. Its purpose is an old-fashioned argument with a provocative proposition, considered responses and a good-natured free-for-all. And to that end, this year the argument will be delivered by an equally feisty and fierce woman who's spoiling for a fight, Shen Narayanasamy. Shen is GetUp's human rights campaign director. She led the No Business in Abuse campaign, which targets corporate involvement in mandatory detention of asylum seekers, the Let Them Stay campaign, which aimed to prevent the deportation of hundreds of asylum seekers to Nauru, and most recently she spearheaded the Bring Them Here campaign. Shen's background is as a human rights lawyer and advocate working in Australia and across the Asia Pacific on issues of economic justice and land rights. Please welcome Shen.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for making it on a Friday night. I'm really appreciative. I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and their elders both past and present. I want to do so not just because this is an important matter of respect and protocol, but also in terms of a discussion of who can come to this country and the circumstances in which they come, an important reminder of the foundation of this nation, which claims one sovereignty by trying to extinguish another. So 1 year ago, I was sitting up high in a glass tower of one of Australia's biggest banks, promising something I didn't have. I was there to talk to the bank about companies like Transfield that operated Australia's offshore detention regime. Companies the banks loaned to, companies the banks invested in. Together with a committed group of friends, I was making the case that no respectable business, no bank, should associate itself with the unlawful and abusive system of offshore detention. HESTA, one of Transfield's largest shareholders, had just dumped its shares in the company. And now we had the ear of the banks. We were discussing the quiet advocacy that particular bank could undertake with the Prime Minister. The banks always prefer to keep things quiet. As a prod to the PM to find a better outcome for the people on Nauru and Manus Island, the bank would flag their uncertain financial support for companies like Transfield. And that's where my promise came in. The bank wanted to hand the Prime Minister a policy brief about alternatives to offshore detention which also work to prevent people drowning at sea. Sure, I promised, I'll get you that brief. I didn't have it to hand, but I'm sure somebody did. Little did I know that that casual promise would lead myself, along with colleagues from GetUp and across the refugee sector, on a critical journey. It was a journey to a truth hidden in plain sight, right under our noses. It would lead us past the alternative policy options themselves, past the pantomime of the government's border security, all the way to the Great Migration Con. The Great Migration Con is a political con that denies us the opportunity to look at our migration system holistically, that leaves the system vulnerable to corruption and inequity, that bars migrants from the potential to truly become a part of our community, that prevents multiculturalism from flourishing, and that cheats us of the opportunity to break the deadlock of offshore detention. And like all great cons, this one starts with the numbers. A few weeks after my rash promise to the bank, I was buried under a dizzying array of spreadsheets from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. I was in search of an answer to a simple question. How did a few thousand refugees arriving by boat every year compare to our overall migration intake? I mean, surely we had a total migration figure somewhere. As the experts will testify, not so. I pored through the figures on permanent migration, from skilled migration to family reunion to humanitarian. Then I dug into the burgeoning group of long-stay temporary visa holders, from students and working holiday visa holders to the often maligned 457 group. Then I added them all up. My jaw dropped. At their panic-inducing peak in 2013, boat arrivals brought 25,173 people seeking safety to Australia. Over the exact same period, we welcomed 818,863 people on a variety of long-stay, temporary and permanent visas, without anyone batting an eyelid and without the sky falling in. In fact, over the course of just one fortnight, more people arrived in Australia to work, study and live here than arrived by boat that entire year. That entire year, we had an average of 2,200 people, migrants, coming through our arrival terminals in our airports every single day. But it was the graph function that really blew my mind, which is not something that people admit every day. For when I plugged in all the numbers, going back to 1984, I initially had a very steady line, but it suddenly skyrocketed following the election of one John Winston Howard. Prime Minister Howard, the deeply, deeply conservative leader of a relaxed and comfortable Australia. By the time he left office in 2007, John Howard had more than doubled Australia's intake of migrants. In fact, as a percentage of our population, he had doubled the overall intake compared to any other peak period of immigration in our post-Federation history. More than the populate or perish times of the 1950s. More than during the great thirst for labour during the Snowy Mountain hydroelectric scheme. More than the peak of Vietnamese boat arrivals in the 1970s. Not only did the volume of migrants radically increase under this supposedly conservative Prime Minister, but who was coming and for how long they did as well. As Peter Mayers outlines in his fantastic book, Not Quite Australian, Prime Minister Howard had stated, "I think you either invite somebody to your country to stay as a permanent resident or citizen, or you don't." But despite planting this flag for permanent immigration and permanent status for people arriving, John Howard, in fact, had begun an incredible shift in the opposite direction. In fact, the year that John Howard left office, 87,000 people entered the country on temporary 457 visas alone. And from a time in the mid-80s when almost one in five people we welcomed was on a humanitarian basis, the humanitarian intake plummeted to one in 50 by the time John Howard left office. Now, as that graph illustrates, this was a shift that has been carried across by every government since, that has seen Australia move in real terms and numbers from being a settler migrant nation to a temporary migrant nation. There it was, the statistics staring me in the face, moving my understanding of ourselves as a nation built on immigration, citizenship, multiculturalism, to one that in large part effectively treated immigration as a tool for a workforce of non-citizens. Staring at my graphs, I thought, perhaps I just hadn't been paying enough attention. I don't have a PhD in migration. Perhaps this wasn't as much of a con as maybe I just missed the coverage. But then I thought, no, wait a minute. I do remember the last 20 years. At least I think I do. I remember voting in my first federal election in 2001. I remember the lectern-thumping speech where Howard spoke those words, "We will decide who comes into this country and the circumstances in which they come." There was no way I could have forgotten it. We were reminded every single night on TV that in ads that repeated that phrase until it was knocked into our collective heads. And during all that time, what I don't remember is John Howard talking about doubling our immigration intake or taking us to the highest proportionate migration intake in a century. Was I just confused? Were we all suffering under some sort of collective hypnosis? Or perhaps, as happens in politics, did one piece of rhetoric simply overshadow the rest, leaving us with a distorted memory of Howard's words and actions? To check, I went back to John Howard's 2001 election victory speech, a long and thorough exposition of every single policy priority under his government. The "We will decide" line made its inevitable appearance, sandwiched comfortably between a discussion of terrorism and Australia's decency as a nation. But not a word about doubling immigration or a wholesale shift from permanent to temporary migration. So maybe if we're all a bit confused, because we're supposed to be. Immigration specialist and sociologist Catherine Betts commented in 2005, "The Howard government has won many voters from the Labor Party by appealing to patriotic values, while at the same time responding to pressure from business interests for a higher migration intake." So far, the electoral contradictions inherent in the government's immigration policy has escaped the attention of most coalition voters and of most political commentators. Fast forward nearly a year after Catherine Betts's comments to the 2013 election, and there were signs that the coalition was more explicitly getting its wires crossed. Fiona Scott, the Liberal candidate for Western Sydney, said to an ABC reporter, "Asylum seekers are a hot topic here because our traffic is overcrowded." When asked to explain her view, she said, "Go and sit on the M4. People see 50,000 people coming in by boat, and that's more than the population of Glenmore Park," which is a suburb in Sydney. Now, Scott was roundly mocked, including by myself. But after years of her party's open-door immigration policy on the one hand and dehumanisation of asylum seekers on the other, you could forgive her some confusion about who exactly those pesky foreigners were clogging up traffic on her highways. The Conservative leader of the day, Tony Abbott, made no effort to clear up the confusion or to talk up the Liberal legacy of big immigration. "Obviously," said Abbott, "when you've got something like 50,000 illegal arrivals by boat, that's a big number. We have all sorts of pressures that are created." The fact that, on a purely mathematical basis, 50,000 people creates nowhere near the same pressure as 800,000 seemed to be irrelevant. As they say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. The current Prime Minister has a more artful argument. Just 2 weeks ago, Malcolm Turnbull told the UN that Addressing irregular migration through secure borders has been essential in creating the confidence that the government can manage migration in a way that mitigates risk and focuses humanitarian assistance on those who need it most. Indeed, public support for immigration has stayed largely positive. But where is the Prime Minister's evidence, Malcolm Turnbull's evidence, that support for his immigration program exists with the knowledge of the major shifts in intake and details of the makeup of the migration program? Every poll I've seen on immigration in the last 15 years, and I've looked at nearly all of them, blandly asks whether you support the current immigration levels or not. There's no historical context, no numbers, no we're seeing the greatest period of immigration in our history, post-Federation, nothing. No context whatsoever about what those levels are. As Philip Corey, writing in the Australian Financial Review 2 weeks ago, stated about John Howard, once he brought people smuggling under control, immigration numbers hit near record levels and the punters never noticed. So perhaps a better way of working out whether it's just me that's confused or if there is a deliberate silence here is to ask, why haven't both major parties been trumpeting from the rooftops their bipartisan support for a massive immigration intake and how absolutely, wonderfully, economically and socially successful it has been? And as far as I can see, there are three major reasons why they haven't. And depending on my political cynicism or yours, you might think it is more of one than the other. The first reason, and I'm starting with the positive, is because presumably to speak about immigration, the reality of the intake, the fact that the sky hasn't fallen in, and in fact our big immigration program has driven jobs and growth, is to empower the Hansonites and invite the anger of the electorate. I can feel this fear. I feel it tonight. Why talk about it? Why say the magic number? What happens if Pauline Hanson hears me? There is clearly a concern on both sides of politics and in business that if Australians actually realised how many people came to this country each year, they would reject those numbers. There is a concern that the power of thundering pundits willing and able to exploit people's fears around economic uncertainty, willing to stir fears about those numbers, would only grow. But there's also a flip side, and that brings me to reason two. Of course, it is easier to win elections by stoking fears around a tiny number of people who arrive by boat than mounting the case to a disquieted and anxious public about the benefits of high levels of immigration, indeed uncapped levels of immigration in some areas. It's far easier than mounting a case about the benefits of a completely diverse migration intake full of Asians and Muslims and Indians and Africans. Instead, corner off a few thousand asylum seekers amongst the 800,000 people arriving each year to be the repository of our fear and the target of our political scapegoating. It clearly works. And as George Megalogenis put it in The Howard Factor, it's the story of how the former Hansonite belt think Howard is keeping out all the foreigners when he is bringing them at a rate that Paul Keating never contemplated. The third reason comes from a, if not the, driving source behind the shift in our migration program, business. Big business clearly supports our new migration program. They argue vigorously for it behind the scenes and publicly in dense, jargon-heavy submissions about productivity and labour shortages. But will business get stuck into a bitter public debate about migration? About who should come to this country and the circumstances in which they come? Oh, no. As Henry Sherrill, an ex-Department of Immigration bureaucrat and advisor to the Migration Council of Australia, put it, with no small degree of irritation on his blog, I've worked in and around migration policy for the best part of 8 years, and I'm increasingly becoming convinced the big business community in Australia does not have the will or the ability to prosecute a public argument on migration. Almost meekly, they sit by the sidelines and watch as others shape discourse. So if the con exists, if the population is largely in the dark about all of this, what are the consequences of this radio silence on the reality of our migration history? The first thing to note is that the silence clearly hasn't worked. You can't convincingly and confusingly give the impression of tight, secure borders while simultaneously overseeing the largest proportionate intake of migrants Australia has ever seen without somebody noticing. Pauline Hanson is back. And unlike the two major parties, she's not limiting the fear-mongering to boat people. If your whole strategy is based on victimising a helpless minority to distract the public from real policy, someone will eventually come along who can play that game much better than you can. Meanwhile, wholesale changes, numbers, balance of permanent versus temporary, ripping away of family reunion that have been made to the migration system have been instigated with relatively little coverage, relatively little debate or discussion. It hasn't stopped the demagogues and the talkback radio hosts from carrying on, but it has had negative impacts for migrants and the rest of us. In dark places, in a Department of Immigration presiding over a program the most basic elements of which have been kept hidden, bad things flourish. Just a smattering of headlines from the last year give us a snapshot of a migration system that has been left vulnerable to corruption and crime within the department itself, that spends an eye-watering amount of money outsourcing to contractors like Transfield, with no proper tendering process whatsoever, and that as a consequence of policy being built on short-term gains is now incredibly complex, incredibly arbitrary and burdened by enormous fees. The 7-Eleven scandal blew open just one case of a business building enormous profits from underpaying and overworking vulnerable temporary workers and international students. So who then is benefiting from this silence? Not immigrants under our current system. Family reunion, the bedrock of our migration program for many years, the ability to bring your siblings, your parents out here, now stands as a waiting list of almost 25 years. Or a payment of $100,000 to jump the queue, the irony of which I don't have to point out. Not the 457 visa holders who work here in front of our noses every day, but whose pathways to citizenship and a permanent invitation to our community look dim. Not the international students, whilst the university sector and business profits from people paying enormous fees to study here, most of them, as surveys show, in the hope to build a life in Australia, for many thousands and thousands of dollars later, that hope is just a fantasy. Not even the Australian public, who in the absence of any public debate or education or just building a mandate around immigration levels, understandably take on the view that there is something to fear as a direct result of our politicians' ramped up rhetoric on border security. And not, as I discovered, moving from my spreadsheet of numbers and trawling through the history books and the speeches from John Howard on, the asylum seekers arriving by boat to our razor wire and our turnbacks, our fear and our consummate failure. Because I still have a brief to write for the banks, remember that? And suddenly that brief proved remarkably easy to complete. And to explain why, let me go to another election, the one we just had. In the early weeks of this year's federal election, Immigration Minister Peter Dutton tripped over a political fault line. Somewhat careless at best with his language, Dutton's insult about refugees not speaking English and simultaneously existing on welfare and taking Australian jobs was taken as a slight against all migrants. The public was outraged. Today's show host, Carl Stefanovic, a descendant of immigrants himself, slammed the comments as un-Australian and suggested Dutton issue an apology. "Not only for those arriving now," thundered Carl, "but those who have come and now gone, giving their blood, sweat and tears and handing down their values to the next generations, who are many of our leaders today." Dutton had struck a nerve, if he's getting that from morning television. But more than that, he had exposed a contradiction only obvious when the migration con is revealed. For in a year when more than 800,000 migrants were welcomed to Australia, when the sky didn't fall in, when our economy was turbocharged through their entry and our culture enriched, how did 25,000 people fleeing for their lives on leaky boats ever constitute a crisis? Both parties gravely warned and have for decades that a dastardly economic migrant might be on one of those refugee boats. Yet at the same time, inviting hundreds of thousands of economic migrants each year, and trying to demonise economic migrants to an entire country largely comprised of people who all share a history of economic migration. Within days, Dutton had realised his mistake and shifted back to the predictable ground around asylum seekers. Offshore detention may be harsh, but it's the only way to save lives at sea. And because of the utter silence around our immigration intake, we believe it. We're oblivious to the obvious alternatives, and we don't bother asking the very people whose journey takes them across rough seas to our shores. And while doing this brief, we did ask them, and let me tell you Ali's story. Ali is a Syrian citizen with family living in Australia who've been here for over 20 years, who are Australian citizens themselves. He escapes the nightmare of Homs and tries to secure a family reunion visa whilst displaced in Syria. But there's a 25-year waiting list. His family in Australia tell us they put in application after application to no avail. After refusing to use his skills as an engineer for a corrupt and brutal Syrian regime, Ali tries a different tack. What about Australia's skilled migration intake? But because he's from a war-torn country producing refugees, he's flagged by our own immigration department because, ironically, he could be trying to seek safety and a permanent life here. He tries to get his son, who's about to enter university, a fully paid university place as an international student, because the thing with refugees is before they were refugees, they were ordinary people who studied and worked and paid taxes and ate and danced and drank. Again, flags. He couldn't even pay for a fully funded university place for his son. Same reasons, same rejections. And this is the perverse reality of it. The fact that Ali and his family might be fleeing danger not only doesn't help them under the regime we've constructed, it actually and practically precludes them from formal pathways to migrate to this country. In our infinite wisdom, we have set up an entire system designed to deter potential asylum seekers from any other way of getting here than through an increasingly plummeting humanitarian intake. So what does Ali do? Well, what would you do when bombs are raining down on your tent in Syria, and there's no formal way to get out? Run. Pour your savings into the hands of a people smuggler and run to the only family you have left who are safe, family in Sydney. But unfortunately for Ali, he ran into Kevin Rudd and our PNG solution. So Ali has been on Manus Island for the last 3 years. Ali's story is not unusual. While it's very hard to get accurate numbers from the people on Manus and Nauru due to the fact that both those sites essentially operate as black sites, advocates talk all the time about so-and-so whose cousin is in Perth and so-and-so whose sister is in Wollongong or Sydney. And well-researched examples of the phenomenon of deterrence closing down options for formal safe migration comes from Europe. Surveys of refugees and migrants by the International Organization of Migration have found that for some groups crossing the Mediterranean over the last few years, over 70% had a first or second order relative in their destination country. More than half of the Syrians and Iraqis surveyed from October last year to May this year had relatives in their country of intended destination. And this is before we get to even the usual reasons why people seeking safety can't apply through everyday formal migration pathways. They don't have their documents. There's no sign on a non-existent Australian embassy which says apply for visa this way. They have fled to a neighbouring country and they can't complete any of the requirements necessary because they're in the neighbouring country, not the country of application and citizenship. So what are your options if you're one of these people? In a February 2016 speech, Oxford University Professor of Forced Migration and International Affairs, Professor Alexander Betts, summed up the three realistic options facing people seeking safety in the current system. One, lengthy encampment, more than 20 years. Two, urban destitution in a neighbouring country. Or three, a dangerous journey. For people seeking safety through an attempted dangerous journey to our country, they face a fourth fate, mandatory, indefinite, non-reviewable detention. As any economist will tell you, when you ration something, you create a black market. And we've artificially rationed safety by utilising a system of detention and deterrence to actively block the safe and usual immigration pathways that 800,000 other people take to those who need it the most. So if there is a boat people crisis in this country, it's partly of our own making. So really the brief wasn't that hard to write. The answers were there staring me in the face, and to the eternal credit of many hardworking academics and experts in our sector, refugee sector, written out in weighty detail in many policy papers. I'd just been prevented to truly understanding them by the fact that I'd drunk the migration con Kool-Aid. In fact, just a month ago, our own Human Rights Commission published a lengthy and detailed outline of all of the policy alternatives. So how do we construct an alternative to Manus and Nauru? And I know I have to tell you, so I'm going to tell you very fast. We could do three simple things. Firstly, we have our migration intake. Remove barriers to it. Facilitate access to family reunion and labour migration. Facilitate international student places from source countries like Syria, from neighbouring countries like Lebanon and Turkey. We've enacted similar programs before. Why don't we just acknowledge that Australian communities whose home countries like Syria are facing war and devastation should get a priority opportunity to bring over their cousin or their parents? Every single analysis of migration shows you that if you come and you reunite with family, those people are automatically set up to be in a better position to deal with the resettlement and migration process than somebody else. Why don't we assist Indonesia and Malaysia in reviewing and assessing the displaced persons in the region to open up opportunities for formal migration, not simply under the barrier of the refugee intake? Why don't we offer an opportunity to those young men stuck in Indonesia and Malaysia to, instead of paying a people smuggler $20,000, to pay for a university place? Second, re-establish Australia's participation in humanitarian resettlement from our region. Instead of banning, as we now have, resettlement for UNHCR-assessed refugees from Indonesia, why don't we use some of our $3 billion that we spend on detention and up our humanitarian intake from our region to 50,000 per year? Focus it on the most vulnerable. Focus it on the women and children and the groups of people who have no hope in hell of accessing our migration intake, even if we change it up. Third, why don't we work together with Indonesia, Malaysia and Thailand? Offer an aid package for a stability program, an initiative that could provide legal rights of stay, which currently don't exist, an ability for those people languishing in Indonesia and Malaysia to work, to study, to live a life while they're awaiting the endless, lengthy UNHCR refugee processing system. To do so would change the current situation where the only opportunity, if you're a mother in Indonesia, to get your child an education while you are waiting for the years in which your refugee place is being processed, is to get on a boat and take them elsewhere. We could spend $1 billion on such an aid package, and we wouldn't even touch the sides of the current spend we have in detaining people and deterring them and pushing them back out to sea. Not to mention that providing this kind of aid package and funding and support would be a clear indication to our regional partners that we are willing to come to the table, willing to share responsibility, and willing to stop just pushing boats back into their national waters and washing our hands of it. The eventual endpoint is a regional coordination framework, which the refugee sector has been talking about for years on end. But you have to start somewhere. And when you open your eyes to the reality of the migration intake and the reality of the political con, you can see that we can start right here and right now. But I can hear the government response now. It's a dangerous journey. What about the people dying at sea? And I would say yes. It is a dangerous journey, so offer alternatives to the journey, as I just did. As the poet Wassan Shire says, you have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. But understanding is far away if you have created boat people as a group so very different from the 800,000 others who come here each year. Boat people who are shamed for wanting to seek safety here, while it is a virtue in everybody else. Instead, all of our responses have been premised on the notion that the only way asylum seekers can be convinced onto a plane, an in-flight service, and a movie, instead of a boat, is to enact a dramatic, unlawful, abusive system. We have those, you know. We have planes. They've been remarkably absent from the debate. But apparently, we can't simply remove the blocks to arriving on a safe plane journey to stop people arriving by boat. Instead, we have what we do now, which is mandatorily detaining their children in a way that the vast majority of paediatricians in Australia determine to be child abuse, to spend $400,000 per person per year detaining them, to tear families apart, traumatise young men, leave women showering in front of leering guards on Nauru and Manus Island, and destroy our international reputation and relations with our closest neighbours. Because that is what we would rather do than just offer alternative options to human beings just seeking some small measure of safety. So what have I learned, other than don't make rash promises to big banks about getting them a brief in 2 weeks? I've learned that the silence must stop. The con has to be ripped open. That there is a way to do this right, and because we are at best afraid to do it wrong, we have what we have today. We already have in this country a huge migration program. And as I've said repeatedly, the sky is still up there. Instead, this migration program has turbocharged our economy and greatly enriched our community. We are already a diverse country, and that diversity is an enormous social good. So why do we as a nation keep repeatedly shooting ourselves in the foot? Why do we make it hard for people to join our community? Why do we fail to lord our system of immigration from the rooftops? And why do we allow demagogues and politicians to dominate the debate with slogans and scapegoating? And why do we make it hard for those people to come here and join our community? Why do we put them on temporary visas where they are obviously open to be exploited in any way and every way, shape or form? Why do we block them repeatedly from getting here through safe and formal pathways? And most of all, why do we detain them? We say, get in the queue to Ali from Syria. And when he tries to do that as best he can, while bombs rain down on him and his family, we block him, we detain him, and we expose him to horrific, expensive abuse. Enough. We have all the tools available to build an immigration program founded on human dignity and benefit to those coming and those of us here already. And there is no earthly reason why people seeking safety can't be a part of it beyond cold, calculating politics. And that, my friends, is the argument I put to you tonight.
Shen, as much as I want to hog you tonight, in the spirit of the Dai Gribble argument, I want to give the audience as much opportunity as possible to interrogate you this evening. So I'm only going to put a couple of questions to you, and then we're going to have some roving mics, and I want all of you to have a think about the kind of questions that you want to put to Shen, and we'll have a bit of back and forth, biffo, not literally. Shen, you acknowledge in your argument that people are very reluctant to mention the I word, immigration, that people are wary that Pauline Hanson might hear them, that it might be taken the wrong way. Weren't you concerned to invite this kind of conversation in the current climate? Isn't that dangerous?
Well, I suppose the first question to ask is who is benefiting from the silence? Like, is it actually current migrants? Have we created a system where we're really truly helping them, and the kind of demagoguery and Hansenism that exists in that silence is somehow not impacting them? And I'd say no. Like, if you look at the protests of the Indian taxi drivers at 7-Eleven, at various other things, and even as a person from an immigrant community myself, things have gotten worse. So I think the first question is, does the silence benefit the people whom it affects or not? And I'd say it doesn't. So then the question is, are we afraid of having this argument? And I think about who wants to avoid it. The government wants to avoid it, the opposition wants to avoid it, and business wants to avoid it. And if they aren't going to avoid it, if we rip this open, what are they going to have to do? And there is a risk that, especially in the current climate with Malcolm Turnbull and obviously a resurgent right, that they would take the lead of Pauline Hanson. But there's also a chance that they would have to come out and defend their legacy, because they are well, well aware of the importance of immigration in this country. It's just that they're not talking about it. So it is risky, but the people who we should care about and who should have the most authority over this aren't benefiting from our silence. It just makes me uncomfortable.
You characterise the silence around immigration as a con, as a deliberate ruse. Is it that, or is it more a matter of just short-sightedness when it comes to cooking up policy? Is it more a stuff-up than it is a con?
I mean, it's hard. You see, I mean, you just look at Peter Dutton's comments after he said the refugees simultaneously being on welfare and taking jobs. I mean, any immigration minister sitting atop one of the highest intakes in history that's uncapped, which is the incredible thing, saying words like taking Australian jobs, there's something deliberate in that. But I also think that over the course of 15 to 20 years, it doesn't require a conspiracy, it just requires a cultural pattern, ways of thinking. And I think Peter Mayers' book on temporary migration talks about it quite interestingly, because he talks about in that book how immunisation in this country, it wasn't provided free immunisation, which of course is provided to most children, all children, wasn't provided to the children of temporary migrants, which of course undermines the whole notion of immunisation. If there's one person who's not immunised, it undercuts the whole thing. And that is obviously not deliberate. It's an oversight, which means the levers of policy all the way down into the state-based health departments aren't aware. So I think, as I said in the speech, there are three possible reasons, but there are probably more. Mm. And in reality, it doesn't really matter. The question, I think, is why aren't they lauding it? And that, I think, is the more interesting question in some ways.
Okay, I'm going to share you with the audience now, because I'm sure there are plenty of questions and comments. If you are from a particular organisation, if you can flag that with us, that'd be great, just to put your comments in context. But if you could just put your hands up really high and someone will come to you with a microphone.
Good evening. I'm from the Wheeler Centre Admiration Society. Thank you very much for another fantastic presentation tonight. Shen, I'd like to take up one point. You did say that parents would never put their children on dangerous boats when they're in a safe place to begin with. Apparently, Alan Kurdi's father did exactly that, and the little boy ended up on the beach in Turkey. Mm-hmm. Can I just also mention that tonight there was a big crowd waiting outside. Everyone waited in line very patiently, and when the doors opened, we all moved in. No one cut in line. And this is not a right-wing conservative crowd. My view is that people are perfectly happy to have an organised refugee intake as long as people aren't showing up demanding to be let in. If you'd like to comment on any of that, thank you very much.
I think that what you touch on is a legitimate concern in the sense of how does one create equity in a system of international crisis? And I think the two responses to that are, and Alan Kurdi's father is a very interesting example, because if you remember what I said about Alexander Betts, the Oxford University professor, he said there's three choices. There's living in a refugee camp. Now, this is because the system is broken. We're living in a refugee camp. The waiting is around 20 to 25 years. And actually, it's not a queue. It's more like a lottery. So there's a tiny amount of resettlement places, but that goes to 2% of refugees a year, and you don't just move up in that queue. So in some ways, even the 25-year waiting list is kind of a bit confusing because it's not definite that if you wait those 25 years, you'll get through it. So that's your first option. Your second option is urban destitution, which is where Alan Kurdi's family was in, which is living on the streets. And you can see this, and if you go and look at the footage coming out of Lebanon and Turkey, you've got Syrian children and families on the street doing God knows what. How on earth they make 2 cents, I don't know, but you can probably imagine, and the research indicates exactly the kind of exploitative labour those people have to do to just survive. So that's your second option. And your third option is that dangerous journey. So what I'm advocating, actually, is we can create formal, managed, safe processes. In all of the palaver about talking about this being the greatest movement of people after World War II, there was a great movement of people after World War II. We benefited greatly from it. People got stuck in, agreed that immigration was worthwhile, created a process and put people through it. Exactly what I'm arguing for is a process. But what we've created instead is a false notion of an international process that somehow has to be adhered to when, in fact, it's not working. And the way of adhering to it is by actively pushing back people and pushing them back not only literally on boats and through detention centres, but through our formal migration pathways, clearing them out of those as well. So I suppose that's my response.
Do you think there's ever a way of ensuring that no one will ever get on a boat?
No, there's no 100% guarantees in life. But I suppose what you've got today, it's a very interesting example, is we have indefinite detention or being pushed back into a sea and boats have still set sail. But I think what you say is, as a matter of public policy, can we create an orderly, safe, managed process? Yes. Do we have the capacity to do far more than what we're doing? Of course, because we take 800,000 a year. Is this a matter of political pantomime? Yes.
All right, next question, please.
Thank you. Shen, I'd like to know what response you got from the banks when you presented them with your brief, if you've been able to do that, and did that change their attitude at all or prompt them to say they will support the cause and be active about it?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. In fact, we're about to publish the brief that we gave to the banks behind the scenes. It'll come out at some point over the next week. And yes, the banks have been very supportive. And I think, you know, it's very easy as part of the refugee sector, and understandably, to get really irritated at the Australian public debate. But I think, as one of the early questions indicated, there are genuine moral questions. And in my experience, actually, the banks and the majority of people in the corporate world were very concerned about the thought that people could die at sea. They understood, and I think Turnbull reflects this in his rhetoric, he says, harsh but fair. You know, people understand fundamentally that what we're doing isn't right, but they are struck by the pantomime of moral authority that one is required, abusing one person is required to stop another losing their life. So the bank's response has been fantastic, and as you know, some of you who might be aware of No Business Abuse will know. So when we started, there were three companies involved in the offshore detention centres, and up to, I think, a few weeks ago, the last one has said that they're leaving the centres. So the support from the corporate world, both here and globally, has been incredible. It's been nice to talk facts and evidence instead of political sloganeering with somebody in this debate.
Had they experienced that before? Had they had anyone come to them to talk to them face-to-face about that issue?
So there has been public campaigning going on in relation to corporate involvement in detention centres from the beginning, including by the refugees and asylum seekers themselves. But because of my history in economic justice, what often is missing is just taking the time to go and explain. And we published a report, actually, a very, very lengthy, painstaking report. And you kind of have to get involved in the corporate world in that way and go through their own policy parameters and explanations and hoops in order for your argument to make sense. So that, I think, was new in this context.
Okay. Hi, Shan. Thank you so much. That was so enlightening. I'm interested in the 12,000 places for Syrian refugees that I think Tony Abbott said that we would take in over and above, I believe, our existing intake, he said. I looked on the Australian government website the other day to kind of try and figure out if anywhere near 12,000 Syrian refugees have made it to Australia, and the website seems to suggest that 8,000 of them are in the process of being processed. I don't know where they are. When I read that figure, I was like, that's bullshit. I'm sure 8,000 Syrian refugees are not in Australia. But then I was thinking, well, maybe they, after I heard what you said, I thought maybe they are, and maybe the government have been fantastic to them and don't want to tell us that they're here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you have any light to shed on whether or not you believe that that 12,000, that intake of 12,000 is happening or will happen, or what you make of that promise.
Well, I think that indicates, you know, our immigration department and the levels of bureaucracy and paranoia that's starting to characterise it. So if you compare over the equivalent period, the Canadian government has managed to reset, I think, 25,000. And as far as I can tell, it's very hard to get accurate figures. There's around 3,000 of that Syrian intake that are here in Australia. It's very hard to know if the government has double counted, because obviously we do have a humanitarian intake, which is also around 13,000. And there are, yeah, as you accurately point out, around 8,000 in processing. So I think they are here, but again, as an indication of the way in which the con has worked to target a small number and try and avoid highlighting kind of the government's agenda in terms of everybody else. We were just discussing before we got on stage, actually, that, you know, I think there's like 90 Syrian families that are supposed to be being resettled in Eltham, in a refurbished aged care facility there in a couple of months, and there's protests from far-right parties, and Pauline Hanson just did a little Facebook video about how it's a terrible shame and it's refugees versus rapegees, I think they call them, versus, sorry, my eyebrow can't go up high enough, versus the elderly. It's on Current Affair tonight.
Does that suggest that it behooves the government to resettle people quietly? Do they have to settle people resettle people quietly for fear of that kind of reaction?
I think that's a government that doesn't want to deal with the fact that it has racism in its populace. Mm-hmm. And by being quiet, they're just encouraging it. Like, why is it on Current Affair? Why hasn't Malcolm Turnbull blooming flown down there and kissed all of the babies?
How much is race at the heart of this?
Oh, sorry. I mean, not that they want to be kissed by Malcolm.
I'm
making assumptions here.
How much is race at the heart of this?
It's very much. I mean, I think there's a reason why I wanted to start with the acknowledgement. I don't think you can understand this phenomenon without understanding the invasion that happened at the beginning of this country and what lies we've told ourselves since. And I think as well, I mean, people often say this to me, and in the context of migration as well, which ignores the fact that consistently for every group that's come in and hadn't borne the brunt of Australian racism, we've still had Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who still bear even more of the brunt. But, you know, there's this thing of like, oh, well, every group gets it. First, there was the Italians and Greeks, and my partner's Greek first, you know, his nonna will tell stories about this. Italians and Greeks, and then you had the Asians, and then you had the Indians, and then, you know, who are Muslims now. But what that is a country that doesn't want to admit that it, and doesn't know how to stop being racist.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't stop by ignoring it and pretending it doesn't exist and pandering to it and not addressing it. You have to do the kind of mandate building that we do about everything else, that they do about the GST and superannuation, every other policy.
But politicians would argue that they talk up the fact that we are a proud migrant nation. Isn't that enough?
That's about it. You've said the one line. We're a proud migrant nation, sandwiched between terrorism and our decency. Yeah.
Should go into politics. Okay, who's next?
I sometimes wonder what it would be like if there was some calamity in England or America and people started struggling to get to Australia, English people or American people. Can you imagine that we would push the boats back if they came by boat and pop them in detention centres? It's absolutely unthinkable. Of course we would accept them.
Well, we wouldn't just accept them. We'd set up a special visa class in our migration system and we would have Qantas jets going over there and they would step out to the strains of orchestras. That's how you would do it.
Who's next?
That's rather cynical. It's the cynical day as opposed to the maybe they're doing this because they're too afraid of the Hansonites day.
Thank you, Chen. Our family has welcomed two young Hazara boys from Afghanistan into our family, and these young men have suffered greatly at the hands of the Taliban. So in their young lives, they have this great accumulation of loss already. So that's one aspect. The other question I suppose I'd like to ask you is the nexus, particularly to do with many of the people seeking refugee here are Muslim, and the issue of terrorism and how that is put together as if somewhere there's going to be some terrorists are going to come in. I just wonder if you'd care to comment on that.
Sure, and congratulations. I think this is, you know, some of the stories that we know are out there of the many communities and many families who've actually taken people into their homes and their hearts, which is the most, that's the celebration. That's why I talk about we shoot ourselves in the foot all the time, because we are a country that can and does do that, and we don't celebrate it at all. In relation to the joining of the issue of terrorism, Islam and refugees and rape, I think the important thing to note about it is that it does speak to, and we know this from surveys, a level of cultural intolerance in our country. Mm. And what it does is it departs from evidence-based approaches to crime, which is what terrorism should, and dealing with terrorism should be, an evidence-based approach to crime, and it constructs a narrative of culture and religion over the top of it. And then what it does is repeatedly tell that story from the front pages of newspapers and the mouths of politicians over and over again until they're conjoined irretrievably in the public mind. And that's why we see a situation today where we're doing that. And we have those opinions of, you know, depending on how much you believe the efficacy of the polls, around 49% of this country wanting to stop Muslim immigration.
Thank you very much. My name is Nell Minnie, and I'm an academic activist. And thank you so much. That was really interesting. And all the time you were talking, especially that series of why. And I'm sensing a huge elephant in the room, which is about the profits that are made, for example, from the visas, as opposed to free humanitarian entrance. They get visas and you get a cheap labour force, you get an exploitable labour force, huge student fees. And also I'm thinking about the transnational corporations that actually run and profit from these centres. So you started off talking about business, and that's the silence. And there is a huge silence there. I think, you know, I always follow the money. And somebody is profiting from that enormously. including deportations, airlines are profiting, food companies. So a lot of profit is made on the backs of those asylum seekers. And a lot of profits are made from the 800,000 migrants who are not allowed to stay. So it's almost looking to me a bit like a guest worker type, but a dishonest one. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, people always say, oh, you know, the Arab countries, Saudi, they don't let you stay. But instead of us, we Australians always have to think we're good people. And I think we are good people, but the people are taught to be racist in a way. And the racism is, I think Stuart Hall calls it a floating signifier. You can use it for here, you can use it there. It's a very useful thing. So for me, the elephant in the room is the money, the huge profits that are made on the back of the misery of those people who are in asylum, and which justifies and silences all the other immigration, the 800 immigration, 800,000. But I also feel that there's something about not being able to, in this country, to really... I don't know if we're really... Because the people don't want this. I mean, I know 49% have said that they don't want immigration, but actually when it comes to it, if there's a crisis, people are good. People are generous and good Australians, as far as I know. And so partly that the democracy in this country, we're not represented. You know, what people really want isn't represented. But the other thing is that it really takes the question away from militarism. Mm. And I think, well, you know, it's like, who is bombing Syria? How are we implicated in that? And what money is made out of the arms? So I don't know if this is a question, but I'm just saying that all those whys, you know, if we looked at the underbelly of all the things you're talking about, the really silent parts, that's when you start to see why it goes on, because people are profiting.
And so, I think you're very right. I mean, this is part of the risk in talking about the immigration con, actually, is that it's not so much the immigration word, although there are obviously risks about even saying that. It's the con part. In some ways, it's annoying because people want to talk about the con and whether it's real, what's in it, everything. And I think that's a really great debate. But what I want to concentrate on is, if you know, what can we do? I mean, we're imprisoning people 2,000 right now, and the only reason that bring them here, the only reason that government can give for why they shouldn't be brought here is it would restart boats. And talking about the con means we talk about the brief, the alternatives, they already exist. And so that is where I think we need to move to right now, because we have an immediate humanitarian crisis. And so I suppose as an activist and as a campaigner, we're throwing this con out there so that we can move it on. And also because even the people who agree, even many of the people in this room, even myself, even the banks when we talk to them, ethically, they don't like what we're doing, but they were really stuck by the notion of there's no alternative. And so that needs to be exploded as a concept.
One more question. So lucky. We've got...
Great talk. Thanks, Shen. Lots of fantastic ideas. And I think you've maybe answered my question. I was going to say, as you pointed out, both sides of politics, both of the two big political parties, are implicated in these decisions, and that in a sense has painted themselves into a corner, but they're also divided internally themselves, and that to me is a huge block. I mean, I think providing solutions that people can move to is a great way to go, but do you want to comment on the political situation where they're both implicated and where both of them are split within their own parties, which is sort of hamstringing progress?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. So part of, I mean, I'm obviously the Human Rights Campaign Director at GetUp, and we are and we will release the brief, yeah, translated into kind of plain English with a lot of graphics, and over the next few weeks, and we will campaign very, very heavily with the 1.1 million members who are part of GetUp across the country, taking that brief to MPs, asking them to attend a national summit to talk about alternatives as a moment for both parties maybe to break some of that bipartisan consensus, encourage the outliers to come out. Mm-hmm. We know we have a lot of support in the state parliaments, including you might have seen the premiers who came out around Let Them Stay. What we need to do is provide this alternative and constantly repeat to the public and to politicians that it's possible, and try and shift the debate onto why won't you have a discussion about possibilities, even if maybe one of my ideas might not work for X reason. There's more. There's lots of them. Instead of this constant cycle of we've got no other option but abusing children and men, women, for years on end, because otherwise somebody might set foot on the boat. So that's the plan, and hopefully we'll get there.
Are you reaching the right people with GetUp? I mean, how do you speak to the Fiona Scotts of this world? How do you reach them as well?
So we did this with Let Them Stay, and I think the first and the, one of the best decisions we made with Let Them Stay was to not brand it. So we, as an ex-human rights lawyer, the notion of a hashtag just seems beyond, below me, but I must say I'm a convert. So, and I'm a convert because in the NGO space there's a temptation to brand everything, and what a hashtag does is give you the opportunity to run a common narrative and a common campaign that everybody can share in without branding. So I think that that is one of the first things you do. And the second thing we did was utilise absolutely everybody across the spectrum. So we drove advertising to the so-called persuadable cohort, which is, you know, you poll and you test, and there's a group of people out there who's around 30% of the Australian public who are open to having their mind changed, who are open to new ways of thinking, and we test messaging and drive it to them. And the way it works is talking about human beings. Because unfortunately, the refugee sector, we talk about undifferentiated mass of people, we talk abuse and trauma. I can't go home after a night. Like, if my partner puts on something that's a bit full on and abusive and traumatic on TV, I'm like, you know what? I kind of just want to watch Sea Change. So it's a, it's actually
old
not
school.
Like, actually, Sea Change, yeah, watching it for the second time, not actually. I actually did Downton Abbey. This is being taped, isn't it? Oh, no.
We'll edit it out. Fix it in post. It's okay.
It's a human reaction. And actually, we tested it to the nth degree. You tell human stories and people are changed. It's unbelievable.
Is 30% enough to shift the dial on it, on this? Is it enough to change the politics?
Yep. So Let Them Stay did. Let Them Stay, our goal was to go from 25% support, which is where refugees basically... My opinion on refugees is shared by 25% of the Australian public, which, mind you, had gone backwards over 15 years. Our goal was to shift that dial, and shift it we did. Over the course of 9 weeks, we shifted it 15 percentage points, which doesn't sound like much, went up to 42%, but 5 percentage points wins an election. And it showed me that the Australian, you just don't give up on the Australian public.
On that hopeful note, I'm afraid we have to end it, but if you do want more... Shen. She will be on Q&A on Monday night, prosecuting the argument again in front of a live audience. No pressure there. Good luck.
No pressure.
Please join me in thanking Shen Narayanasamy.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.